This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Shaoning, and joining me in the studio is Philip C.
Good morning.
Good morning, right? Nice day so far. It's just gone past 6 a.m., second day of March. So it's Tuesday, like I say, 2nd of March, and the second day of school for a lot of kids.
And was your kid a first-class kid, according to the New Straits Times?
I don't know.
Year 1 and year 2 pupils actually complied with SOPs.
I think children, you know, I don't think we give them enough credit. Yeah, in terms of taking instruction, following rules, and understanding what's important. Because a little story, my nephew went to school yesterday, first time after like being out of school for almost a year. But you know what? He knew two important things. One, to ask for pocket money. And two, to ask his mother for sure where his class was, because he didn't want to go to the wrong place.
Was the pocket money inflation adjusted? Because actually inflation was close to zero. So did your sister say no?
Adjust. I'm not sure what she did. Maybe she gave him the excuse that it's an economic recession and he needs to take a pay deferment or pay cut, poor kid. I'm not even sure canteens are open actually because of COVID-19.
True, actually. So what's the point of the pocket money?
Well, I think he was just trying to shake down his parents. You know, why not? Any excuse. But in the meantime, what stories do we have, Philip?
Well, we have a very interesting story about tweets, death by tweets. So we have a interesting Biden cabinet confirmation candidate that's in jeopardy because of her historical tweets.
Oh yes, I've heard about this one, right? This is the one that's unlikely to get passed.
Unlikely to get passed because of her past tweets.
Interesting. And up next will be a discussion on CEO pay, because I think over the last few years, I think our eyes have just rolled wide open at some of the staggering sums we pay people. And the question, of course, is that fair? Is that right? Is it equitable? Are we paying them too much? Are we paying them too little? And now the big question, do we claw back? And we saw some of that recently happening. But as usual, let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We'll have more for you in just a few minutes, but here's this very cool song, More Than a Feeling by Boston. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was More Than a Feeling by Boston. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Shaoning, and of course I'm joined by Philip C. It has just gone past 6:07 in the morning. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of March. And up next is an extremely interesting story by The Economist. And it's entitled, How to Design CEO Pay to Punish Iniquity, Not Just Reward Virtue. But when I read this, I'm also a little bit sad because I realize how underpaid I am.
And like, so don't worry, I don't think we are classified in this category. Yes.
Yeah, I guess I don't want a Fortune 500 company. I'm not a CEO. You know, I'm just a presenter on BFM. So, okay. Thanks, Philip, for bringing me back to earth. Yeah. I needed that slap.
My pleasure.
That slap. Dush, dush. Wake up, Shani, wake up.
Doesn't apply to you.
Doesn't apply to a minion like me. But anyway, guess what? For the CEOs out there, you know, this life is so difficult. It's a dilemma, right? What is fair pay? Or if you're paid well and you did something wrong, do you have to pay it back? And I think this article asks these, you know, difficult questions. Although I wouldn't mind having just more pay, full stop.
Well, look, this comes to the main crux of the issue, which is it's quite easy to reward good behavior, but deterring the bad is an afterthought. It's kind of hard to punish iniquity or if you've been badly behaved. And this is not a new idea, this concept of clawback, where there's a provision in pay plans that gives the board the right to yank bonuses or stock awards given, but later found to be unjustly earned. It's not new because it was around in 2002 in America through the Sarbanes-Oxley reform to basically punish errant bankers.
But it's not very widely practiced, is it? I mean, this article highlights a few examples. Of course, Malaysia's in there too, because I think Goldman Sachs has yanked or tried to yank back as much as $175 million from their executives who were involved in 1MDB.
It's a good point, which is, I think a lot of people have adopted it. So nearly 93% of those in the S&P 500 have actually some element of this. But execution and adoption is a totally different question. So that is the multi-million, trillion-dollar question we have to ask. But what they've done is, for example, Wells Fargo, they did claw back $28 million from the CEO of John Stumpf as he tried to create this culture encouraging employees to open fake accounts.
Okay. Right. Yes, yes. I actually watched a Netflix documentary on it.
Right. And McDonald's, yeah. They recouped $57 million worth of severance pay from its ex-boss for being fired over sexual relationships with underlings.
But, these examples don't always end well. And of course, we go back to Goldman Sachs, right?
Yes.
Because apparently, well, it's not apparently, Gary Cohen, its former second-in-command who cashed in his pay awards on joining the Trump administration in 2016, didn't want to pay back his salary.
Yep. And in the end, they negotiated and he put it into a charity. And it kind of lost its intent and translation.
Well, it's a bit of a slap in the face, right? Because they're basically saying you did a bad job.
Yeah.
You were incompetent. You allowed something negligent to happen. So much so that Goldman Sachs got fined by the U.S. Justice. So, of course, they won their, Goldman, as part of this process of rehabilitation, has to also go after the people that signed off on the dotted line. So everyone's really accountable. But at the end of the day, is it just kind of like, okay, like you did something wrong, a little slap on the wrist and then off you go? Because when you think about the total pay package these people received the last 10, 15, 20 years, you're talking like 8-figure salaries at least, right? So what is like $10 million to these guys?
I guess it's symbolic. I think what you're kind of alluding to, it's a drop in the ocean in terms of what they're overall paid, but it does tarnish reputation. But the reputation was already tarnished prior to this. So you're kind of giving a little dunder.
A little dunder
to,
as opposed to like the 10,000 if you break the SOPs and the 1,000 if you break the SOPs. Lah.
Yes.
So it depends. If you're the ordinary guy on the street, the 10,000 would be very
percentage,
painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. For someone else, it might be just like nothing, lah, right? So I guess it's all relative.
That's true. Building on the Goldman Sachs story, and which is related to Malaysia, the AmBank news yesterday, where there was a RM 2.83 billion settlement. I think in Malaysia, we haven't gone to this level of adopting clawbacks.
I try my best, and if any listener can remember a clawback, let us know. I really would like to know. You can, of course, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Really, because at the top of my head, I can't remember a single incident of clawback. Maybe it does exist.
Because with AmBank especially, I'm wondering whether there was some mechanism in place to do that.
Question mark.
Yeah.
And I think I want to conclude by making us feel even worse than ever, Philip. Because
Xiaoning, must we do this?
On Tuesday morning, definitely at 6:12. And I'm staring at Bloomberg, my favorite terminal in the whole wide world. And
your
I'm
boyfriend.
Looking, yeah, I'm looking at the Hang Seng, I'm looking at what is a function in Bloomberg called Pay Index. And it lists all the best paid CEOs in the world and also ranks their performance. So guess what, guys? Number one is Elon Musk. He's paid $595 million. Current value, only $6.8 billion. But his performance is a one star.
How do they calculate this performance star, one star, two star thing?
Oh, okay. One star is basically negative economic profit of $250 million or more. Five star is pay to 3-year average economic profit less than or to equal to 1%.
Oh, but that's quite easy for him, lah. He can go from one star to five star very fast.
Yeah, he can. And the five star champion is Timothy Donald Cook, Apple CEO. Because when you think about Apple, revenue is amazing, right?
That's right.
So he's only paid $133 million. Net worth, actually not that much. Half of what he was paid last year, because he's worth $308 million. Small change. He's not even a billionaire, I guess, because he didn't create Apple. There's this guy, Thomas Rutledge. I don't know who he is. He's Charter Communication, one-star performance, telco, RM117 million. And I just want to highlight some of these names, like Sundar Pichai, Alphabet CEO, $86 million. $111 million is his current value. He got four stars. Satya Nadella, who's Microsoft CEO, four stars too. He got pay of $77 million. Do you feel better now, Philip?
I feel incredibly happy that, you know, with my salary here, it's fine.
I hear a bit of bitterness. But anyway, let us know what you think about your pay. Let us know if you know anybody who's had their pay clawed back. You know, you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we'll have some messages. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was The First Cut is the Deepest by Sheryl Crow.
Excellent song.
It is. When I think about this, my heart goes out to those who had pay cuts during COVID-19. No, seriously. And it's always heartbreaking, right?
It really sears into your mind, this whole pay cuts thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a fact of life. I mean, you know, COVID-19 creates a K economy. Some people actually have done really, really well. I mean, you look at the salaries of some of these CEOs, right? If you're in the right sector, if you're in technology, whoo, fantastic. And you work from home winner, fantastic. Mm. But if you're in aviation, hospitality, tourism,
retail.
F&B, retail, it's really tough times. And, you know, you might have had to put in for some pay cuts on yourself and also on your staff. And you wonder, when is recovery going to take place? And I think everyone feels that. So when I heard this song, that was the first thing that crossed my mind because I'm that kind of economist in me, you know.
Yeah, it's very interesting because talking about organizations, many of them are actually thinking more about, let's do a pay cut for everybody so that we survive as a collective, right? As opposed to let people go.
Yes. And that was the case. More compassionate approach. And that was clearly the case when you look at some of the data coming out of the Department of Statistics, whereby the unemployment rate actually was actually not so high. I think because, like what you say, they actually adopted this approach. And guess what? The Department of Statistics, the CEO, Dato Sri Dr. Uze, will be on the Breakfast Grill later at 8:05. So you can understand some of the. I will be asking him some of this methodology about unemployment. So it's a good listen if you're a bit of a geek and you like numbers.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, we have this article in front of us. It's a Wall Street Journal opinion piece. And it's entitled, Neera Tanden's Death by Twitter. And it's about, you know, asking us or questioning us, should we be judged by tweets or any social media, if you ask me, right, that we posted quite a while ago? Should that determine whether we can be hired or fired?
Well, you know, just some context to this article. Neera Tanden is one of was Joe Biden's pick to run the Office of Management and Budget, right? So she's actually she ran this think tank, the Center of Left, progressive think tank, which is pretty good think tank and well regarded. But it's her tweets that are drawing all the flak because she's basically made quite nasty commentary, calling senators all sorts of names, right? So Mitch McConnell. She's called him Voldemort, Ted Cruz called a vampire, Tom Cotton a fraud. So all these tweets are resurfacing and it's really sad because she does seem to have the expertise and the CV, but it is these personal jabs that have really gotten her into hot water.
So it's not a question about her competency, am I correct?
That's
maybe
correct.
A question about her character, because do these tweets reflect your character? And are they the right thing to do? I think now we're in this 2021, social media is here to stay, whether or not you like it, right? And it's prevalent. And my reservation about all these, okay, I think most listeners will know I'm actually quite private. I don't tweet very much. I don't do much social media. I don't come from a generation, I would admit, where my opinions are online, available online. They're pretty much in my mind and that's it. Or maybe I share them with a few people. Because in our time, I don't know, Philip, it wasn't so common. You know what I mean? Facebook was it's a new phenomenon to me. Twitter is a very new phenomenon. Instagram, even more strange to me. I'm still trying to figure out how to post a picture without making it look bad. That's my achievement of the day. So I think it's a generational thing also. But I also understand sometimes when you tweet something, because of the nature of social media, it's very instantaneous, right? You have this satisfaction. It's like saying something, you know, like I'm mad.
Get it off your system.
Yeah, you'd tap away and post. So sometimes there's not much reflection. And then later on, you think, huh, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have said that. But unfortunately, it's out there in the world wide web. You can't take it back. So do you think it is fair to judge people for something that was maybe posted in haste?
Okay, so So this, I think you're referring to, has some element of cancel culture. Mm. And we had this conversation with our producer, Sim, where he made a really good point. How much can your past be responsible for your future?
Sometimes it can. I guess it has to be examined in closer detail, exactly what you tweeted.
And if it's sticky, right?
Yes.
So even when they asked President Obama, what is your advice to, you know, aspiring people trying to find jobs? Be careful what you post on social media. So with the case of Neera Tanden, she had 18,000 over posts and she had tactically decided to delete 1,000 tweets.
That's quite a bit, you know.
That's quite a bit.
Yeah.
So I think it was a very conscious effort. So how you also redeem yourself is a very important element throughout this whole process.
Because if you think about it, 1,000 out of 1,000 out of 88,000
tweets.
Was she a compulsive tweeter? Is that what it
seems
was?
Seems like it.
So she deleted, of course, I whipped out my calculator. She deleted effectively 1.1% of all her tweets.
Mm.
Now, if you want to be mathematical, is that a lot? Is that too little? I mean, does it show that she doesn't have, I suppose, thought when she does things like this?
Yeah, the volume worries me, the 1,000, because she basically decided that she was going to be selective about her history.
I think there's no right or wrong answer, right? And, you know, in this era of social media, we are still evolving in terms of the rules of engagement. Shall I call it that? Or what is right? What is wrong? Interesting concepts to think about. But as usual, do let us know what you think. Should you be judged by your tweets? WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we have the news bulletin. And to take us there is There Is a Light That Never Goes Out by the Smiths. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:40 in the morning. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of March, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Wong Xiaoning and Philip C. And that song was Local Boy in the Photograph by Stereophonics. Rather cool name. I always wonder who comes up with all these song title and bad names.
Must be visualized by seeing a local boy in a photograph.
Probably. But in the meantime, we are looking at some of the international headlines. And first off, it's actually probably COVID's success story, New Zealand. Because New Zealand is actually having a debate over how to handle rule breakers, with Jacinda Ardern's government under pressure to ensure compliance with COVID-19 precautions. So the city of Auckland has entered into lockdown for 1 week beginning Sunday after a community case of unknown origin was discovered.
Yeah, this is on the back of 2 weeks ago. They had actually done a three-day lockdown when they discovered three cases. So I think the frustration here is that this whole in and out of lockdowns probably is frustrating a lot of people, and questions are being asked about compliance. How are they enforcing it? Because currently, potential penalties are up to 6 months imprisonment or $4,000 fine.
Yes, I think the opposition National Party is basically asking for greater enforcement of self-isolation directives and fines for those who broke the rules. However, commentators on the other hand have also said that a punitive approach could backfire and that it could lead to people withholding information. Now, I actually heard a news clip of Jacinda Ardern telling people to actually tell their friends and family members who have broken the rules and call them out for doing so. And she even cited an example. So she said, if you see someone on public transport not wearing a mask, give them one. Not just put them down, but offer them one. You know, I guess it's the all of community approach rather than just saying, okay, you got to do a fine, which you have to sometimes, but basically also understanding and offering people help if they're not complying.
Yeah, you don't want everybody to be some self-enforced enforcer to go out and say, hey, you're not wearing a mask, you're not doing this, you got to, you know. At the same time, we all want to be vigilant and be aware of the surroundings. So it's a really delicate balance leaders have to put in place. So Jacinda Ardern, a bit more left-leaning social, I think, wants to take a bit more holistic approach, whereas I think the Conservative Party wants to be clear about the consequences if you miss.
But she is telling people, you know, if you see somebody not following the rules, tell them
for sure,
you know, be okay about it. And I thought about this from my perspective, because sometimes when I go to the supermarket, for example, the classic, you've got all these lines drawn on the floor, right? They're kind of like self-explanatory by now.
Oh, people don't follow.
Yes. And I turn around to people and say, can you stand behind the line, and they give me this stare. Yeah, this death stare. Like, how dare you tell me this? And I'm like, hello, we're still practicing physical distancing. You know, this is the least you can do in terms of the SOPs, right?
Right.
Why is it that I even have to call you out?
Do you think it's this humiliation that you get for being admonished in public? So then you get this black face, right?
I mean, actually, I have had people tell me off, like, you know, like, and sometimes I'm glad for it because
you're not aware.
You're not aware. And, you know, we're all human. We are all human. We make mistakes. Sometimes we don't even realize we made a mistake. And I think it's good that I'm reminded and people shouldn't take it personally because it's not about you. I'm sorry. It's about all of us having a community approach. But moving on to other news in the COVID world. Studies have come out of England that have showed that the one dose of the Pfizer or AstraZeneca vaccine reduces the chance of needing hospital treatment by 80%. So the effects kicked in 3 to 4 weeks after the vaccination based on the sample of people over age 80 who received the virus.
You're getting a lot of good news about how effective these vaccines are. You know, not only Pfizer, but AstraZeneca. So in my mind now, right, when you get all this data, how are you adjusting and recalibrating your vaccination program? Are you increasing your intervals between the first and second dose? And one of the things for Malaysia especially is how or how fast do we accept these kind of medical news and then decide how to adjust our programs accordingly? That's a question mark for me.
I think then what is very critical is that there has to be openness and sharing of data. So every country who's rolled out their vaccination programs and are ahead of us, and they're, you know, the classic, of course, is UK and Israel. Those are the two countries, right, who have been very aggressive. They need to share the data in terms of how it works. Who have they vaccinated? How successful has it been? How much has the hospitalization levels dropped off? The death rates dropped off? And then we can also learn from this. Because let's face it, you know, this is a new world. We really are finding our way
right.
in terms of what vaccines work. I mean, and all vaccines work, but I guess what approach is best, because the idea is to create herd immunity as soon as possible, reduce the any stress on the health system. Those are the key things, and reduce the death rates. So I think for us, Malaysia, we have a lot of to learn from other countries.
Absolutely, and we have to have the agility to change our strategy over a period of time. I get very nervous when people say you have to have only one clear strategy to execute this.
But I think
this.
It also must have some clarity and not flip-flopping. For example, what is a frontliner? I think you see... You know, you see it on social media,
sure,
right? There's a lot of heated debate as to what is considered a frontliner. Shouldn't it just be really medical professionals, people who are in hospitals? Should it be considered politicians? And then what kind of politicians? Like what level of politicians?
That's a fair comment. The things, although like intervals of vaccinations or how you distribute it effectively, I think those things should be adjustable based on scientific data that comes out.
Yeah, so many question marks about a vaccination rollout. Who should get it first? Who should it be? You know, who is considered a frontliner?
That's right.
You know, and I think we're still working out all these kinks. But as usual, let us know what you think. Give us your thoughts. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we'll be taking a look at the front pages of our daily newspapers and online portals. We'll be back after these messages, so don't go away. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was Stomp by the Brothers Johnsons. And I hope that woke you up because it is just gone past 6:52 in the morning. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of March, and maybe for some of y'all, getting up, slowly easing into the day.
What a bubbly song.
It was. It was a very bubbly song. I like the tune very much. But what do we have in front of us?
Philip? Numbers.
Oh, your favorite.
My favorite. So vaccine COVID numbers, right? So Kyrie had announced that 17,064 people have been vaccinated up to 11 a.m. yesterday.
Okay.
Right? Now, the interesting thing is vaccine COVID Twitter handle had actually broken down into the top three states, and Sarawak is leading with 7,400.
Yeah, I heard that they actually were very early in sending out their letters as to who should get the vaccine. They were very aggressive to, you know, in informing the frontliners, which also includes, I think, some members of the media who are out there. I mean, so who are busy doing press conferences and who are exposed to, who have the potential to be exposed to COVID-19 because of the nature of their work. So kudos to Sarawak. In terms of having a, you know, I think a statewide kind of plan Now, of course, it's going to be a challenge for them because they are an enormous state, right? And development is very uneven there. So I'm just curious how they're going to send the vaccines to the, I guess, deeper parts of Sarawak, in the jungle, for example.
Yeah, so deep diving and looking at it, they've even broken it down to districts. So even the 7,000, it is at major cities like Kuching, Cebu, Kinta, Muka. 822. So it does sound they have tried to spread it, but you know, it's going to be more challenging when you go into the interior side of Sarawak. Now, then another number is only 1.4 million people have registered via the MySejahtera app for the COVID-19 vaccine, and that's only 6.1% of the population.
Well, everyone needs to hurry that up, right? But I'm just curious, is this really a right number? Because we have a total population at 32.7 million, something like that. But certain children, for example, are not going to be vaccinated at this juncture, right? Because there's not enough study or data.
We should agree on this addressable population.
Yeah, it should be. It shouldn't be just like, you know, take this number and divide it by the total population. It should be take this number divided by the people who should take vaccines.
That's right.
Who should take the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, I have the HCO morning brief in front of us. And I'm looking at this article, which is MOF Secretary General Azri Hamidon is going to chair the 5G SPV. And like we mentioned yesterday, Ralph Marshall has been confirmed as their CEO. So now, I guess, with the rollout, question marks about, you know, whether the 15 billion price tag, how will it be spent? What is the procurement policy? How transparent will it be? What are they going to charge the telco operators? And I've also read reports that it's not just going to be totally government funded, because some of the telcos will have to cough up money. How does that work? Is it a public-private partnership? I'm curious. Lots of questions, and I think I'll be following this news very, very closely, actually.
Yeah, 15 billion over 10 years.
Yeah. And then after that, what's going to happen? Is it really going to be much cheaper for consumers? Is this the fastest way to roll it out? And I think we are the first that I know of in terms of countries that's just doing it on a, or in using this kind of model, because most countries have basically told the telcos, okay, bid for it, and then you guys roll it out.
Yeah, I wonder who will manage the maintenance of the infrastructure also.
Lots of interesting contracts to award out there, right? The other news, of course, is Top Glove, because yesterday, I think it was announced, or the day before, or even on Friday, it was announced that they are looking at a tri-listing. Can I call it? Because it was a dual listing, so let's call it tri-listing.
Singapore, KL, now Hong Kong.
Yeah, in Hong Kong. And actually, a share price took a tumble. It sank below 5 ringgit, which is a key psychological level. I think some analysts came out to say that as a result of this, there will be dilution to the shares as much as 11% to the earnings. So unsurprisingly, that was not well received by markets.
Yeah, I think the goal was to raise 7.7 billion, of which 4.6 billion was to expand its production capacity.
But do they need that kind of money? After all, they just did a share buyback, right?
Absolutely.
So if they did a share buyback, which maybe now doesn't, like, why did they do the share buyback when they need this money for CapEx expansion?
Exactly.
So was there like...
Why not just distribute more dividend?
Yeah, or just save your money and then use it for CapEx later, rather than now go and look for a tri listing, unless your argument is that you want greater visibility since you're the world's world's largest glove maker. Who knows? But as usual, let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. That's all from the local papers this morning. And coming up next is a 7 a.m. news bulletin, followed by more business news and analysis, where we'll be finding out where global markets are headed with Joe Quinlan of the U.S. Trust Bank of America Private Wealth Management. But to take us there is The Big Yellow Taxi by Johnny Mitchell. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.